did tour the Tar Sands, I think 2000, I want to say 2019, in Alberta, Canada. And so what we seen there was the tailing ponds, and they were being contaminated. And then we also got to hear from the community. And so some of the Indigenous communities in Canada are really impacted. They cannot drink their water. Their traditional medicines are contaminated. And there's a lot of Indigenous people that have cancer or other underlying health issues. And then also, too, when I was up there, they wanted to feed a traditional meal. And I think it was salmon or trout. I can't remember. I think it was salmon. But they were going to feed us a traditional meal, and then the traditional meal had cancer tumors, some of the fish. Mm. But unfortunately, we didn't eat the cancerous fish, so they threw that back into the river. And so I guess just witnessing it all, like witnessing to see what's coming, and then also too, like hearing some of the elders cry and tell us their stories, and then like about even pregnant mothers, how it's really hard for them, and it's a struggle to have their water resources and the traditional medicine, because before the tar sands came into the Indigenous communities in Canada, they didn't have skin lesions. They were able to like brush their teeth. They were able to take a shower, but now they have to haul gallons of water. You remember the 5-gallon jugs, how heavy they are?
Yes.
So they have to haul those into their communities in order just to, you know, have clean drinking water.
Welcome back. My name is Ishika Utari, and I'm the host of the Pipeline Podcast. You just heard me speaking with Hunkpapa Lakota, an Oglala Sioux activist and ACLU Indigenous Justice Organizer in Montana, Miss Angeline Cheek, who is from the Fort Peck Reservation and has been diligently battling the Keystone XL pipeline for years. We were just discussing the impact of tar sands oil on the environment and Indigenous communities. As I mentioned in the first episode, since 2016, the Keystone XL pipeline has delivered approximately 700,000 barrels of tar sands oil per day to the Texas refineries. This dramatic statistic communicates intuitively that oil pipelines are terrible for the environment, no matter how safe and sustainable oil corporations like TC Energy and Energy Transfer make Keystone and Dakota Access out to be. Fossil fuels produce pollutants harmful for the environment and public health, and oil extraction emits methane, which locks in heat and exacerbates global warming. By allowing the United States to easily transport and extract crude oil, oil pipelines fortify our dependence on fossil fuels, pushing us in the wrong direction when it comes to moving to renewable energy sources and more sustainable practices to fight climate change. To make matters worse, the Natural Resources Defense Council, an international environmental advocacy group, reported in January 2021 that tar sands oil is thicker, more acidic, and more corrosive than lighter conventional crude. And this ups the likelihood that a pipeline carrying it will leak. Since it first went into operation in 2010, TC Energy's original Keystone pipeline system has leaked more than a dozen times. One incident in North Dakota sent a 60-foot, 21,000-gallon geyser of tar sands oil spewing into the air. Toxic chemicals from these leaks threaten human health, entire ecosystems, and at least 20 imperiled species, including the San Joaquin kit fox, black-footed ferret, and whooping crane, as the Center for Biological Diversity, an organization that works to protect endangered species, states. In addition to Ms. Cheek's firsthand account, Madelon Finkel's paper called The Impact of Oil Sands on the Environment and Health has shown that the tar sand oil spills from the Keystone Pipeline increase the risk of cancer and respiratory and neurological diseases, impacting Native Americans exposed to the toxic chemicals from these spills. Not only does exposure to these pollutants and contaminated water lead to fatal diseases, but it also makes daily survival more difficult, with Indigenous communities having to test their meat before they eat it and constantly haul clean water from farther sources than the now contaminated original water source, as Ms. Cheek described. These significant hindrances on Indigenous existence demonstrates how pipelines contribute to the U.S. historical attempted genocide against Native Americans. While tar sands oil is more dangerous than crude oil, the Dakota Access Pipeline spills are still detrimental. Hashtag NoDAPL activist Winnea Locke told me during our discussion that
it's definitely win.
When
considering it already broke in like Sprint County in South Dakota.
Yeah.
It already broke in Iowa and also in near Illinois. And then another part where it fractured out at was on the North Dakota side, up in the Bakken where it's actually the oil is actually harvested from. So there's been quite a significant breaks. One thing that's really scary about these breaks is under the river, under the actual Missouri River, there won't be any detection at all. There is no type of alarm safety that could be under the Missouri River to let you know if it's going to break or not, or if it's broken or not. That's the scary part. And it has to be by sight or smell. The thing is like, once it breaks, and this is according to the experts, once it actually physically breaks under the Missouri River, it's gonna flow underneath, and it'll take 2 to 3 days to rise above. So by that time, we're gonna have such a massive amount already leakage before it reveals itself on top of the water surface.
Even though some Indigenous people might care about the environmental impact of these pipelines and view the environment and land as more than commodities, the reasoning for advocating against Keystone and Dakota Access Pipeline goes beyond conservation. This fight is about decolonization and protecting tribal sovereignty. Dr. Andrew Curley, an assistant professor at the University of Arizona School of Geography, Development, Environment, and a member of the Navajo Nation, makes this argument in his essay, Beyond Environmentalism, hashtag NoDAPL is assertion of tribal sovereignty, which is actually a part of Nick Estes and Jaskaran Dillo's incredible book, Standing with Standing Rock. He explains,
saying that environmental narratives aren't addressing the political question of the legal status of tribes about land back, you know, which wasn't in the vocabulary at the time, but is about, you know, restoring lands that were taken, expropriated from Indigenous nations in the history of colonialism in this country. And so those that's what is at core, and that is at core within the Standing Rock Sioux tribes protest against the construction of DAPL. It's about political sovereignty, not just about this might damage the water. Even if like solar development was being built on that land, you know, it would still be in violation of tribal sovereignty. If the Standing Rock Sioux Nation said, we don't want a solar field on this land, and then they said, tough luck, you know, we took this land from you in the 1870s, you know, that's a colonial claim, that's a colonial argument, and that's a violation of sovereignty.
While Indigenous communities believe that the Keystone and Dakota Access Pipelines violate tribal sovereignty by running through treaty-protected lands, the owners of these pipelines deny these claims, creating a clash between two opposite narratives. In fact, Dakota Access Pipelines developer Energy Transfer has created a website called DAPL Pipeline Facts to fortify their side of the story. It includes a quick facts page that addresses misconceptions about the Dakota Access Pipeline, as well as resources like Standing Rock Fact Checker, which was published and written by Midwest Alliance for Infrastructure Now. This organization is a partnership of entities from the agriculture, business, and labor sectors aimed at supporting the economic development and energy security benefits associated with infrastructure projects in the Midwest, meaning that the Midwest Alliance for Infrastructure Now is a completely impartial entity to accurately fact-check on this controversy. Just to be clear, I was being sarcastic. After extensive research, let's engage in some fact-checking of our own. On the DAPL website, Energy Transfer states, the pipeline does not encroach or cross any land owned by the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. Well, the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868 proves this assertion to be false. According to science writer Kimbra Cutlip in the Smithsonian Magazine, in 1868, the United States entered into the treaty with the collective Native American bands, historically known as the Sioux, which includes the Dakota, Lakota, and Nakota peoples, and the Arapaho. As a side note, Sioux is actually the colonial name for Ashanti Shakowin. The treaty established the Great Sioux Reservation, a large swath of lands west of the Missouri River. It also designated the Black Hills as unseceded Indian territory for the exclusive use of Native peoples. But when gold was found in the Black Hills, the United States reneged on the agreement, redrawing the boundaries of the treaty and confining the Sioux people, traditionally nomadic hunters, to a farming lifestyle on the reservation. It was a blatant abrogation that has been the center of legal debate ever since. In 1980, the U.S. Supreme Court in United States v. Sioux Nation of Indians ruled that the U.S. has illegally appropriated the Black Hills and awarded more than $100 million in reparations. The Sioux Nation refused the money, which is now worth over $1 billion, stating that the land was never for sale. In the five generations since the treaty was signed and broken, the Ashanti Shakowin nations have steadily lost reservation lands to white development. They now live in small reservations scattered throughout the region. Both Keystone and Dakota Access Pipelines pass through the unseceded Indian territory, clearly encroaching on indigenous land and adding to the United States' long history of broken promises to indigenous communities. Ms. Locke adds,
so the court already had ruled. So you got to understand, we technically won Dakota Access Pipeline. Mm-hmm. That's what makes this case so heinous, is we technically won. Mm-hmm. By law, we knew there needed to be an EIS, that's an environmental impact statement. We also knew that it was encroaching on our treaty territories. And this is what brings up Indian history and Indian law, where people mm-hmm. don't understand what's the difference between reservation mm-hmm. and treaty territories. Mm-hmm. And that's where Dakota Access Pipeline sits on, is unceded treaty territory of Lakota Nation. Mm-hmm. And so that's in the courts, again, the mm-hmm. district courts ruled in our favor and said, you're right, it does violate your guys' treaty rights. Mm-hmm. Not only does it encroach on your treaty boundaries, mm-hmm. but it also violates your hunting and fishing rights. Mm-hmm. And so we have continuously held that stance as grassroots. Now, I'm only speaking for grassroots. I'm not speaking for the actual tribal entity.
Additionally, the DAPL website includes that Energy Transfer consulted with Indigenous communities on the pipeline, and the United States Army Corps of Engineers had hundreds of contracts with dozens of tribes while the Dakota Access Project was under review. The United States Army Corps of Engineers is an engineering formation of the United States Army that signs off on civic engineering construction projects, especially those on navigable rivers. Since the Dakota Access Pipeline is underneath the Missouri River, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has the authority to assess the pipeline's environmental risks and decide whether the project should continue. Although the Army Corps of Engineers did consult with the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and other indigenous communities, they did not receive their consent. Without the power to veto the Army Corps of Engineers' decision, indigenous voices are clearly unheard by and do not matter to the federal government. In fact, without the ability to offer and deny consent, the U.S. government continues to deny indigenous existence and self-determination, which is a settler colonial tactic. Lastly, the DAPL website mentions multiple Native American tribes in the U.S. benefit from oil and gas development on their land. In North Dakota, the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nation recently negotiated a more favorable tax revenue sharing arrangement with the state from new oil and gas activity on trust and fee lands. The tribe, also known as the Three Affiliated Tribes, earns this revenue based on the amount of oil produced on their land, with 80% of its budget coming from oil and gas royalties and revenues. The three affiliated tribes use Dakota Access to transport more than 60% of the oil they produce. Accordingly, their members stand to suffer significant losses if the Dakota Access pipeline is shut down and Bakken production fails to recover or declines as a result. What this statement fails to include is that despite the fact that the Mandan Hidatsa Arikara Nation benefits from the business, it supported Standing Rock's efforts to stop and move the pipeline. According to Dr. Curley's essay, if we were to rely on the framework of the ecological Indian, we would find the actions of these tribal governments contradictory. However, if we understand tribal support for Standing Rock as a challenge to continued colonialism and the appropriation of native lands for projects that put native communities at the highest risk of environmental damage, we can understand the actions of tribal governments who simultaneously support Standing Rock's claim and the industries that caused the problem in the first place. The owners of the pipelines and others greatly profiting off these pipelines often respond to the backlash Keystone and Dakota Access face by emphasizing their economic benefits, mentioning the great revenue they create for the country, and countless jobs produced. But it is important to keep in mind that the benefits can be inflated, which in no way justify the substantial detriments of these pipelines. For example, the Natural Resource Defense Council asserts, when TC Energy said the pipeline would create nearly 119,000 jobs, a State Department report instead concluded the project would require fewer than 2,000 two-year construction jobs and that the number of jobs would hover around 35 after construction. Ms. Chi confirms this statistic.
I did attend the Trans-Canada meeting, a public meeting, and held in Glasgow, Montana, which is 60 miles away from my community. And I asked the question, because I hear this thing too, like, oh, it creates thousands of jobs, you know, the KXL pipeline, and oh, it's going to do us some good, because they're going to have the money. But honestly, this oil is going to be going over to overseas. Mm-hmm. You know, it's being shipped overseas. I think it's China, because I watched this YouTube video of where it was going to go. Yeah, it's China. And it just kind of baffled me that Trump was really talking mess about China, but then again, like, he's actually helping them out because this Trans-Canada oil is getting shipped to China. I don't know, I just think that just baffles me. And so for the meeting in Glasgow with the Trans-Canada workers, I asked the question, okay, so if I wanted to work for Trans-Canada, how long would I be working for? Because I'm looking for a job. And you know, so then the response was approximately 6 to 7 months. I said, so I'll be temporary worker, correct? Mm-hmm. So they said, yes. And I said, okay. And then so this other guy in the room who was non-Indigenous asked the question. He said, I'm an engineer and I'm looking for a permanent position. You know, how many permanent positions would you guys be willing to hire? Or, you know, because I know some people here in the community. And then the Trans-Canada officials said, we have about 9 permanent positions, and they're already filled because we already have our international workers that will come in and work on these permanent positions. So then the guy just got quiet, and then there was nothing said because law enforcement was in the room too. And I just thought, wow, I wish that I could have recorded this. I can't remember. I think my phone was dying too. But I wish that there was a huge write-up on it just because they actually admitted that they're temporary job positions and they have international workers that come in.
Overall, while some Indigenous communities and people in the low or middle class might have some small gains from the Keystone and Dakota Access pipelines, the true benefactors are the large oil corporations and producers, who are essentially the 1%. Before we find out the current state of the pipelines in 2021, I want to remind you that settler colonialism is inherently a genocidal policy, and show you how the pipelines contribute to the violence too. Ms. Cheek proclaims, if you take a look at these pipelines, they're all going near the borders of the reservations. I see it as an act of genocide, another way to destroy our people, just like how the government tried to strip us of our culture and our ceremonies. To provide temporary housing for the predominantly male construction workers of these pipelines, oil corporations have erected housing communities, infamously known as man camps. Contributing to the genocide Ms. Cheek described and the United States' extensive history of missing and murdered Indigenous women, these man camps have led to an increase of violence against Indigenous women. Honor the Earth, a nonprofit organization founded to raise awareness and financial support for Indigenous environmental justice, explains. The Fort Berthold Reservation, home to the three affiliate tribes of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nations, is located in western North Dakota, and in recent years has experienced an exponentially increasing level of violence against Native women. North Dakota's Uniform Crime Report shows that violent crime has increased 7.2%, while 243 reported rapes occurred in 2012, an increase from 2007 in 2011. Additionally, the Atlantic states, in 2012, the Tribal Police Department reported more murders, fatal accidents, sexual assaults, domestic disputes, drug busts, gun threats, and human trafficking cases than in any year before. The surrounding counties offer similar reports, but there's one essential difference between Fort Berthold and the rest of North Dakota. The reservation's population has more than doubled with an influx of non-Indian oil workers over whom the tribe has little legal control. Despite these inhumane crimes, these men are often not held accountable because of the Oliphant v. Squamish of 1978, a Supreme Court case that established that tribal justice systems do not have the right to prosecute non-natives who committed crimes on the reservation. Ms. Cheek, in fact, has been impacted by the man camps.
When I was up there, I kind of had a little incident with some oil workers. It was me and some youths from South Dakota and Montana that were going back to our motel rooms. And, you know, you could tell they were oil workers just by the way that they were dressed, their hats, and then the gear that they had on, like the reflector. They kind of look like overalls, but they're not. I don't know how to explain it, but you could just tell, like, they were. But they were kind of drinking, and they're like, hey, why don't you come back to our motel room? And then, like, trying to kind of push us towards our way. So then me just being kind of as big as I am, I just kind of just shoved them out of the way, and then we just stayed in our room, and they were just loud, like, all night for one day. And I think that they moved to somewhere else, or not too sure if they stayed there, but I just know that we always had to follow each other in groups. And 60 miles north of where we were, they found a dead woman, you know, just laying near a man camp. And that's one of the reasons, too, why I'm fighting this, too, because it also it relates to MMIW. And here in the United States, where I'm from, the Fort Peck Assiniboine and Sioux Reservation, there's the Bakken oil boom, Williston, North Dakota. There was a lot of increased crime rates, human trafficking and sex trafficking. And even, I think it's called Black Organ Market, something. I can't remember the correct term, but I know that they sell organs.
After years of awareness walks, informational workshops, self-defense workshops, protests and legal observing, Indigenous activists fighting the Keystone XL pipeline experienced a victory. Ms. Cheek remembers.
Like when that first happened on that very first day when he signed the executive order, my emotion was like, hell yeah! I was really happy. I was hopeful, but then again, it made me realize there's so much work to be done.
On January 20th, 2021, President Biden signed an executive order revoking the Keystone XL pipeline permit that the Trump administration granted, blocking the Phase 4 extension from being built and stopping the entire system from operating. The Fort Belknap Indian community, specifically the Assiniboine, also known as the Nakota, and the Gros Ventre, also known as the Ahani tribes, as well as the Osheti Shakwin and the Rosebud Sioux tribe, also known as the Sichangu, Lakota Oyate peoples, as well as their allies, must have been really ecstatic. Indigenous voices were heard and Indigenous resistance paid off. But like Ms. Cheek said, the fight is far from over. Specifically, former President Barack Obama rejected the pipeline during his presidency, and then former President Donald Trump reenacted the pipelines. This history of back and forth demonstrates that the victory during the Biden administration can easily be reversed in the future, meaning that this accomplishment is tenuous and that the fate of Indigenous communities depends on the whims of presidential administrations like it has been throughout the past. The infrastructure of the Keystone Pipeline should be removed so that this victory cannot be undone. Dr. Curley adds,
the Keystone XL Pipeline, which is something that, which is an environmentalist objective, which I happen to agree with, and I think most Indigenous actors and people along the proposed route would agree with. But putting that aside, putting our own personal agreement on this, or our collective agreement on this aside, did that action restore tribal sovereignty in any meaningful way? I don't think it did. I think it did prevent further environmental catastrophe by making tar sands oil accessible to a global market and burnable and part of our larger carbon footprint. That was a necessity, and that was and it's good on that environmental objective. In terms of the question of political sovereignty for the nations, no lands were restored in the process of stopping the Keystone XL. No extension of tribal jurisdiction or governance over those pipelines was part of that process or decision making. So the counterfactual would be, what if the tribal governments had control over those traditional lands and they were the ones that stopped the XL, not President Biden, but the tribal nations themselves? That would be more consistent with decolonization and restoring political sovereignty.
As for the Dakota Access Pipeline, the status quo is much more complicated. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe has been filing lawsuits against the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and Energy Transfer for years through Earth Justice, their legal representation. For example, according to Earth Justice, on February 14, 2017, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe filed a motion for summary judgment asking the court to overturn recent Army Corps of Engineers permits of the pipeline issued without environmental review or consideration of treaty rights. On March 25, 2020, D.C. District Court granted a request by the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe to strike down federal permits for the controversial Dakota Access Pipeline. And on July 6, 2020, the D.C. District Court ordered the owners of the Dakota Access Pipeline to halt operations while the government conducts a full-fledged analysis examining the risk DAPL poses on the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. Unfortunately, the shutdown order was swiftly overturned, and the pipeline has been operating since. This January of 2021, a D.C. Court of Appeals upheld the lower court's ruling that the Army Corps unlawfully issued the pipeline's water crossing permit, but deferred to the new administration to decide whether to shut down the pipeline or ignore its legal obligation and allow it to continue operating. On April 9, 2021, representatives for the Biden administration's U.S. Army Corps of Engineers indicated that the agency will not shutter the Dakota Access Pipeline despite the ongoing threats it poses to the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and the fact that it's operating illegally without a federal permit. United States District Judge on the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, James E. Boasberg, has said while the appeals court ruling upheld the finding that the pipeline is currently an unlawful encroachment on federal land, the ability to act rests largely with the Corps. rather than the courts. He also wrote on March 25th, 2020, that the court thus cannot find that the Corps, which is the Army Corps of Engineers, has adequately discharged its duties and ordered a more stringent review. Specifically, he ruled that the original study did not adequately consider whether an oil spill under the Missouri River would affect the tribe's fishing and hunting rights, whether the project might disproportionately affect tribes and others at risk, low-income communities, and whether the pipeline's effects on the environment would be highly controversial. After all these court battles, we know that the Army Corps of Engineers is currently conducting an environmental and safety review to determine whether the pipeline poses a threat to the tribe. Once the review is complete, which is expected to be around early 2022, then it will be determined whether the pipeline is safe to operate or if it must be permanently shut down, according to our justice. Here is Ms. Locke's predictions on what will occur with the pipeline.
I believe that we're going to win Dakota Access Pipeline because it is an injustice. Mm-hmm. And the courts, the district courts, have consistently ruled in our favor. The only option left for North Dakota and the Army Corps of Engineers to file with is the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court only takes 2% cases annually. Mm-hmm. And they only take precedent cases, mm-hmm. meaning cases that haven't already been decided. Mm-hmm. And since this is a treaty violation, it's already decided mm-hmm. that these are our treaty boundaries. This mm-hmm. is unceded territory land that belongs to Steiner Rock Sioux Tribe on our northern border. And so it's not a precedent case. Mm-hmm. And I think they're going to continuously to find any loophole that they can to maintain the Dakota Access Pipeline, because the United States government doesn't want to admit that they messed up, that they lied, that they mm-hmm. used $30 million in military tactics in hiring mercenaries to attack us.
Since our inaction allows for such injustice to continue and the settler colonial history to repeat itself over and over again, it is imperative that we join this fight against oil pipelines and in support of tribal sovereignty and environmental justice. These are some ways we can do so. Raise awareness about this information. Take a Native American Studies class. If this crucial history is not part of your school curriculum, advocate for it and do your own research. Divest from companies such as Wells Fargo, U.S. Bank, and Chase that contribute to the fossil fuel industry. Listen to and amplify Indigenous voices, and get involved in and support, such as through donations, organizations like Indigenous Environmental Network, 350.org, Honor the Earth, Standing Rock Youth Council, and Earth Justice. Also, write to the Biden administration and the United States Army Corps of Engineers to demand that they shut down the Dakota Access Pipeline. In fact, Earth Justice has an email template to easily write to the Biden administration, and that's accessible through an easy Google search. Ms. Cheek also adds,
how to support each other is just networking and finding out if they have, and they'll also have workshops too, like now since everybody's in Zoom or WebEx or Teams. Everybody usually has informational workshops on Facebook or social media, and I think that it would be good if people can reach out to them and mm-hmm. and ask them, you know, individually, each nonprofit, because each nonprofit does different things. They're all the same. We're all fighting the same fight. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one nonprofit may be taking moves in more of the litigation process, mm-hmm. whereas one nonprofit is buying solar panels for the communities, or, you know, to have those resources. So there's different, even though we're all fighting the same fight, there's different things that, you know, and people can always donate to the nonprofits that are actually doing the work, because they are the ones that need it. Mm-hmm. Even myself, Indigenous Environmental Network, they're the ones that paid for my flight to go to Canada, mm-hmm. To the Indigenous Climate Action informational workshops where I did get to tour the tar sands. And let me tell you something, I think everybody needs to tour the tar sands and get to see the detrimental impact that it does have on all the communities. Because when you tour the tar sands too, you get a massive migraine for a day or two, just smelling the chemicals from the tar sands at their factory.
Thank you so much for listening. I would also like to express my deepest gratitude to Dr. Carmen for her guidance and lessons on Indigenous history, Ms. Wania Locke, Ms. Angeline Cheek, and Dr. Andrew Curley for allowing me to interview them, share their stories, and also for fighting against these pipelines. I would also like to thank all the sources that I referenced throughout that helped educate me and share this information with you all. This podcast will be taking a brief pause in waiting to cover the United States Army Corps of Engineers review and analysis of the Dakota Access Pipeline that is expected to come out early 2022, but I will make sure to keep you updated, cover more Indigenous stories, and maybe even hear what Energy Transfer and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers have to say about their role in perpetuating settler colonialism. In the meantime, I encourage you to reflect, learn more, and especially take action. With limitless power to create transformative change, I'm certain that we will be able to abolish these pipelines and more. Until the next time, goodbye.